When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Ara McCauley, and it covers a new food-sharing initiative running out of Regiopolis Notre Dame High School in Kingston.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Roughly 1 in 3 households in the city of Kingston struggle with food insecurity. This statistic led the city of Kingston to declare a food insecurity emergency in 2025. This spring, the Food Sharing Project announced its latest initiative to help counteract this crisis by opening a school-based food hub at Regiopolis Notre Dame Catholic High School. The Food Sharing Project is a charity that provides nutritious food and equipments to all schools across KFLNA for their in-school breakfast, lunch, and hearty snack programs. Each week, they package and deliver 10 tons of food to 88 schools in 4 different school boards. The Regi School Food Hub will provide prepared hot and cold lunches at no cost for up to 1,500 students at 3 local schools, including Regi students 2 days a week, and meals for St. Francis of Assisi Catholic School and Molly Brandt Elementary School on Wednesdays and Fridays. We sat down with the Food Sharing Project's Executive Director Andy Mills and Board Chair Brenda Moore to discuss the new project and why it's needed in Kingston.
You may not be aware that there are not high school cafeterias operating in either school board right now, and they didn't reopen after the pandemic. There's a couple of high schools where culinary teachers are providing some cafeteria services, but for the most part, the kitchens are closed and they're mainly used for storage. And we found this out before we sort of found out about the National School Food Program. So we've had our eye on this for a while because those are commercial kitchens and there's incredible equipment in most of them. And so Regiopolis was in the best shape. So it would give us an opportunity to get a kitchen up and going. We had to put in a new stove. We had to definitely do some cleaning. For the most part, with a small amount of infrastructure improvements, we could get that cafeteria up and running. So that expansion allowed us to provide lunches for Regi kids and for 2 more elementary schools. So that to us is the path forward. We're next looking at Napanee District Secondary School as our next kitchen that we can polish up and get up and running once we have the funding for it.
The project expands on the Food Sharing Project's Lunches Ready program that provides nutritious, complete meals to any student, no questions asked. Lunches Ready launched in 2025 with new federal funding from the National School Food Program, aiming to support schools that had limited physical and human resources capacities by providing complete, wholesome meals to students, including a main protein and a serving of fruit and milk.
Now we're moving towards being able to actually meet a nutritional gap that families are struggling to provide those very expensive things at the grocery store, the fresh fruit and vegetables and the protein and the whole grains and the dairy. And so we can do that at school. So it's that evolution that we're handling right now. And I think that it's meeting the needs in a different way. And funding is a major challenge. We truly are incredibly grateful for the National School Food Funding Program because it has allowed us to make that expansion into lunches, but more so because it's now legislation. So that's never going to go away, which is incredible. We've never had something like that, and cornerstone now of our funding.
Since its launch, the program has expanded to produce and deliver more than 2,100 meals each week directly to 20 schools.
So last year with the National School Food Program announcement, we knew it was coming and we had a little bit of notice, but in January we received some funding and it was an opportunity for us to try and respond. We'd been hearing from schools that students were seeking more fulsome meals, that snacks just weren't cutting it, or they were dipping into the snack boxes more frequently. Could we provide something more fulsome? So we put a lot of extra hours in, got our heads together, and thought, what could we do to help those schools that are limited with the human resources to be able to do that? So long and short of it, as we rolled out a program in, I guess it was about April or May, we started delivering meals. We called it Lunches Ready, and it's a full main item with protein, with a fruit and milk on the side, which delivered to schools. We started off with, I think it was six schools in the pilot. We're up to 8 now that are receiving it a couple times a week. And then we've also expanded to additional schools where we're delivering what we call hybrid meals, which are meals like casseroles or buckets of soup or things that schools can then warm up. So we're at somewhere around 30 schools, hard to keep track of it, 30 plus schools that are getting meals on a weekly basis. My first few months of working, we were packing and delivering equivalent of about $13,000 worth of food. And then with the pandemic, a lot of families were really, really impacted, and that sort of has hung on, and then the cost of prices and everything increasing. So we're quickly up to $25,000 a week easily on a regular basis. And that growth, it certainly kickstarted, I guess, if you will, by the pandemic, but then it's continued to rise and level off. And last week, I even heard from a school coordinator that they just can't keep the food in the school. They get their food delivery on Monday and it's gone by Thursday. And can they order more? Can they order more? We just keep hearing that all the time.
To support this pilot high school initiative, the City of Kingston awarded a grant of $37,600 through the new Food Systems Framework Fund toward staffing, equipment, and operating costs. Additional funding has come from several sources, including the Federal School Food Infrastructure Fund, administered by Breakfast Club of Canada to purchase startup kitchen equipment and supplies, and the United Way of KFLNA facilitated a generous anonymous donation, which will cover all related costs to extend the project into June 2027.
In a community that there is a large number of families struggling with food insecurity, there is support at schools for any child who is struggling for any reason.
We talk about $25,000 and 10 tons, but there's lots of stories that we hear all the time from our student coordinators and so on about an individual child who's told them that their life has been impacted. You know, the student that was able to graduate and not have to get a job to look after their siblings, or it's just so many stories like that. And so trying to remember that what we do is for these individuals, and donors and supporters and volunteers are doing it for the individual youth and the families that they support.
Ultimately, that's what food sharing is about, is to improve kids' readiness to learn. Because we know that when they can learn and do well in school, then they're more successful going forward. They can reach their potential.
Thank you, Era. Now over to Dinah Jansen with a story by Michelle Dory Forrestel, LGI reporter for The Kingstonist, that provides an update on the ongoing legal dispute between Kingston physician Dr. Elaine Ma and the Ontario provincial government.
Thank you, Jesse. Ontario's highest court has refused to hear an appeal by the Ontario Health Insurance Plan in the case of a Kingston physician ordered to repay more than $600,000 tied to pandemic-era COVID-19 vaccination clinic billings, marking another significant legal victory for Dr. Elaine Ma. In a brief endorsement released Friday, May 8th, a 3-judge panel for the Court of Appeal for Ontario denied OHIP's request for leave to appeal a December 2025 divisional court ruling that had partially favored Ma. Leave to appeal is denied, the endorsement states. The court also ordered OHIP to pay $5,000 in legal costs to Ma. Ma organized 48 mass vaccination clinics in Kingston during the COVID-19 pandemic and was later ordered by OHIP to repay $600,962 because of alleged billing noncompliance. The repayment order was previously upheld by the Health Services Appeal and Review Board, HSARB. However, in a decision released on Tuesday, December 16, 2025, Ontario's Divisional Court found it was unreasonable for the board to conclude that the COVID-19 pandemic did not constitute an extenuating circumstance when assessing Ma's billing. Rather than overturning the repayment order outright, the Divisional Court sent the matter back to the HSARB to reconsider how much, if anything, Ma should be required to repay. OHIP subsequently sought leave to appeal that ruling, arguing that the Divisional Court improperly interfered with the board's findings and misapplied the legal standard for judicial review. The Court of Appeal's refusal to grant leave means the Divisional Court ruling now stands. The matter is expected to return to HSARB, which must reconsider the repayment issue while taking into account the Divisional Court's findings regarding the extraordinary operational pressures physicians faced during the pandemic vaccine rollout. In a statement previously provided to the Kingstonist following the Divisional Court ruling, Ma said the ongoing litigation sent a troubling message to doctors who stepped up during the public health emergency. Doctors were asked to move quickly, adapt constantly, and vaccinate as many people as possible, Ma said at the time. The case has drawn attention locally and within Ontario's medical community because of its broader implications for how physicians' pandemic-era decisions are assessed years later through ordinary administrative and billing frameworks. For now, the Court of Appeal's decision leaves intact a lower court finding that the unprecedented realities of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, a process championed by the provincial government at the time, could not simply be ignored when evaluating physicians' actions during one of the largest vaccination campaigns in Ontario history.
Thank you, Dinah, and thank you to Michelle Dory Forrestel of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little, the LGI reporter from CJPE County Radio, about a mental health crisis in Prince Edward County.
What should we do when someone has a meltdown in a public space? Stay calm. Approach with compassion, speak quietly and gently, and offer help such as taking the person for a walk or calling someone. These suggestions were well received at a recent public information session that focused on understanding common mental health disorders, recognizing distress, and responding in ways that support safety and dignity. Some participants work in hospitality where they witness and try to manage mental health situations. Others volunteer at a charity shop where distress situations are a common occurrence. Psychiatrist Dr. Joe Burley guided participants through scenarios, described symptoms of several disorders, and gave clear suggestions of how to handle a person in distress. Dr. Burley tells us more.
So we all have seen these people. And we all have various reactions, I think, but part of the idea, I think, is just to help us see them as people, because when they do odd things and they have psychotic behaviors, we tend to see them as other, them and us, and we're not like that, and that's, we probably will talk a fair bit about stigma tonight. We'd like to think, I mean, we started to talk about stigma back in the early 2000s or late 90s, and we thought we were doing better, but recently we've actually seen stigma increase again. So, and maybe that has to do with the sort of general climate of the world these days. As we talk about these things, probably a good idea, it would be great if you could think about, how would I react to this, you know? What are my feelings if I seem about somebody like this? What emotions do I have? And what should I do? And we'll talk a little bit about what we should do and what we shouldn't do, I think, with some of these people. I think you can imagine that, if somebody walked up to me in the street who didn't know me and said, you walk funny, I'd be embarrassed immediately, you know? But these people are in the midst of a crisis and often feel like they don't have any agency or control. And so we have to remember that if we want to try and help them and communicate with them.
Anxiety is a common mental disorder, and Dr. Burley describes some symptoms.
And most people won't tell anybody that they have anxiety, like, unless it's somebody very close, because almost everybody I see says, if people knew this, they'd know how weak I am, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's the business of stigma. You know, that's how people see themselves. And I don't think I see very rarely anybody who says, this means I'm weak, or I'm a wimp, or I should be able to get over this myself. And that's probably the biggest stigma thing, I think. It's right at the bottom of everything, along with all the negative judgments and the shaming stuff and that kind of stuff.
What are the other things that anxiety looks like? So talking a lot?
Not sleeping, tremor, intermittent predisposition to panic attacks, rapid heart, muscle tension, tension headaches.
What about irritability?
Yeah, irritability, especially if the anxiety, it kind of fluctuates, right? If somebody's really worrying and somebody wants something from them, more likely to say, get off my back, you know, and be irritable. Insomnia is something we often forget about, is being anxious for hours or days at a time is exhausting. So fatigue is a really common symptom. You know, when I used to started out in medicine, I would be on call for, you know, a weekend. I'd be blitzed by the end of it. I couldn't barely stand up because I'd been like this all the time, you know. And a lot of that physical stuff is not conscious, you know. It just is part of it. So part of helping people get better is helping them recognize.
So that's what it looks like. That's awesome. So now we want to talk about what to do. Can we? So this sounds like it's a situation where we can probably support the person. Mm-hmm. If it's an acquaintance or if it's somebody at the grocery store, what do we do in order to hold space?
I think in the acute sense, is to approach them gently. Don't immediately go up and hug them, touch them. Validate their symptoms. I see you're really upset, you're really anxious, or you're really angry. Nobody's going to tell you you can't be. Is there something that I can do? Is there somebody I could call who could help you? Or would you like me to take you someplace? Would you like to go home? But things that are not threatening. Because, as I said, people are going to be really embarrassed, you know. And many people would say, no, I'm okay. And sometimes it's just worth saying, I know you're saying that, but you don't seem okay to me. Are you all right? And just that, I think, can make a big difference in helping someone kind of settle and be calmer. So the connection, being cared about, and then if you think about in the longer term, talking about it and having somebody reflect back to you what they see helps you see who you are and what you're experiencing. And that's something we can do for each other.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over now to Ted Evans, LJI reporter for CJAI Amherst Island Radio, with a story about community pushback against the forthcoming closure of the Leisure and Activity Center in Amherst View.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Community members in Loyalist Township have come forward with a petition for council to reconsider the closing of the Leisure and Activity Center in Amherst View. In April, staff met with a working committee made up of residents who were looking to preserve services at the center. During this meeting, staff received the petition consisting of over 1,500 signatures. After receiving the petition, staff received a request from a member of council to add the petition to their latest agenda. Council originally approved a staff recommendation to formally close the center as a direct programming space on August 1st, 2026. This came after a close 3-2 vote. Residents who use the space regularly have brought concerns to council, including the size of the new space, privacy, and the costs associated. The matter will come before council again at their June 9th meeting. Loyalist Township resident Lorna Thorne explained the petition and noted the response from the community.
We have collected over 1,500 signatures. for residents in Amherstview, Odessa, and Bath, and the rural areas. Our petition states that we would like Council to take the necessary steps to make a reversal of the 3-2 vote taken on March 10th regarding the decision to close the LAC and move existing programs to the Henderson Community Centre. Going door to door was a new experience and daunting for many of us. We were overwhelmed with the positive response we received from the constituents of Loyalist Township.
Resident of Loyalist Township and former recreation director Cindy Lawson speaks about the need for the center.
Following my retirement in 2013, the space was renovated, and since then, people of all ages have been enjoying a great variety of programs. Disappointment is an understatement when I learned on March 10th, a staff report recommended the closure of the Leisure and Activity Center and Council approved it. I cannot understand how a facility that took over 25 years to acquire is no longer needed. This community is growing. We currently have a space that serves us well. Now is not the time to give it up, as we all know to replace it is not in the foreseeable future.
Loyalist Township resident Barbara Usman Goldhar notes the importance of spaces like the Leisure and Activity Center within a community.
As a widow recovering from illness, I looked to find a center where I could become, where I could begin my healing process. Being a retired physiotherapist with 35 years experience in rehabilitation, I knew the benefits of exercise. I looked for an exercise center and found the LAC just 5 minutes from my home. I realized quickly that this was the place that I needed. As I joined the exercise classes, I found an energetic group of like-minded people who were exercising to keep fit, for example, to maintain diabetic control, blood pressure, and weight gain, prevent aging complications such as osteoporosis and dementia, and recover from serious health issues. Morning classes with instructors who educate and model are particularly helpful as they establish routines, prevent stiffness, and improve energy and mental clarity. The LAC offers a cohesive center where participants get to know each other, find support, and have fun. Large, safe, and well-designed exercise centers like the LAC are essential to accommodate group classes effectively. It is vital to create a community where people can live healthier, longer, and more connected lives.
Another resident, Carla Rogers, explains the concerns residents have brought to council.
We have provided council and staff with the petition, several documents, and photos explaining the opposition to the concept of moving the fitness programs to a room that is half the size with low ceilings, epoxy flooring, and as well as the downfalls of reducing class sizes and spreading them throughout the day. We have explained the shortcomings of the proposed room for the purpose of the children's programs due to the lack of cooking facilities and the reduced space. Community recreation facilities are not just line items. They are infrastructure that support health, connection, and a quality of life in our township.
Councillor Jake Ennis spoke about the potential reconsideration at their June 9th meeting.
I think residents have been very clear about their concerns. I think they've been very clear that they don't want to see a reduction in service. Sympathetic to those concerns. I think it's a positive step that staff are looking at alternatives, and I think it's important for us to consider those alternatives and for the public to consider those alternatives in addition to a potential reconsideration in June.
Councillor Carol Park spoke about the original decision and coming back to council in June.
I believe that council made the wrong decision. That's my personal opinion. And as a swing vote that was part of that meeting, I do take responsibility for that. So I do support this motion, and I look forward to this coming back before council in June so that we can revisit this.
Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend spoke about council's role in decision-making and the importance of municipal politics.
We're elected to be decision-makers that make decisions based on all of the available information and have that be transparent to the public. And so, you know, from that point of principle, we're principally hamstrung until June 9th. And maybe council's decision will be to reconsider and to maintain status quo. I won't comment on what that will be. That could be. But the point is council needs all the information available and the public needs that information. Municipal politics is incredibly important. It's the level of government closest to the public, and that's never more evident than a chambers full of people concerned about what's happening in their community. And regardless of where anybody stands on an individual issue, that's incredibly important.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with the Kingston Sports Report, brought to you by CFRC Power Plays.
Thank you, Dinah. After years of intense recruiting and months of deliberation, Canadian sprinter Wyatt Lee has made his decision. One of the most decorated athletes in Frontenac Secondary School's rich history will be taking his talents to Raleigh after accepting a full-track scholarship from North Carolina State. It has been a meteoric rise for Lee, who made his track debut as a member of the Frontenac track and field team in March of 2024. Lee flashed promise early, tallying an 11.51 second 100-meter dash, good enough to see him advance to OFSA, Ontario's provincial championships. Lee would take home medals in the 100 and 200-meter races that year, while also dropping his sprint time by a full second, a remarkable level of improvement in just 3 months' time. Lee started the 2025 track season by breaking Canada's U18 100-meter record three times in 5 weeks. His mark of 10.38 shattered the mark held by Olympian Aaron Brown, making Lee Canada's fastest high school sprinter. Lee topped his own record again in 2026, running a 10.34, good enough for ninth in Canadian history in the U20 age bracket. Lee has also set new records for the 60-meter dash. He is the youngest runner in Canadian history to clock a sub-6:70.60, something he accomplished at just 17 years of age. Lee is just 0.4 seconds behind Canada's all-time record holder, Bolade Ajimale. From humble beginnings behind Frontenac Secondary School to the biggest track and field meets in North America, the sky appears to be the limit for this Frontenac Falcon.
Thank you to Jesse Bell for that update, and also to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Tuesday, May 19th, we had a daytime high of 20 degrees, feeling closer to 22 in the sun, dropping down to 14 overnight. Wednesday, May 20th, forecasted to have a beautiful 17-degree day with a little bit of sunshine, feeling just a degree warmer at 18. However, it's going to be quite a drop-off overnight, dropping all the way down to 5 degrees. Those cool conditions will remain consistent heading into Thursday, daytime high of 12, but in the bright sunshine, we're going to have a real feel of about 15 degrees. However, it is going to be chilly overnight again, dropping down to 6. Friday, May 22nd, 14 is your high, feeling closer to 18 with all kinds of beautiful sunshine in the forecast, dropping down to 9 overnight. Saturday, May 23rd, 16 degrees is your high, but once again, with the sunny conditions, it's actually going to feel about 7 degrees warmer at 23 here in the city of Kingston. Sunday, May 24th, 17 is your high, feeling like 20, a beautiful way to end your weekend. And then Monday, May 25th, starting off next week, 18 is your high, feeling closer to 21, with a little bit of cloud coverage giving way to sun in the afternoon.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times. Gotcha.
Hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way for you to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Mateos Kervet, who is finishing up his master's in computing under the supervision of Dr. Sidney Gavigi. Welcome to GradChat.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And I know you're finishing up your master's, which is quite exciting. Or your thesis is titled Collaborative Perception Under Adverse Weather Conditions. Can you tell us a little bit what that means?
Sure. So collaborative perception is a subfield of perception for autonomous vehicles.
Okay.
So making a vehicle drive by themselves is a very challenging thing. There's a lot of parts to it. And the usual description is that you have to first get sensing information from the sensors, cameras, radar, GPS, LiDAR, and then making sense of what's around the vehicle. Then you use that information to make decisions.
Okay.
With those decisions, then you have to specifically determine what are the actions to be done. Mm. So accelerate, brake, turn left, right, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of steps to it. Mm-hmm. My research focused on the very beginning, which is the perception part, is making sense of the data that comes from the sensors, you know? And within perception, there is this kind of new subfield, which is collaborative perception, which has the idea that, well, in maybe a few years' time, we'll have lots of autonomous vehicles around. Mm-hmm. So what if they could tell each other what they're perceiving, you know? So if there is challenging scenarios like occlusion, for instance, or situations like adverse weather where the performance of the sensors is degraded, if they can tell each other what they're perceiving, it makes everything safer, you know? So my master's focus specifically on collaborative perception under adverse weather conditions, because collaborative perception is a field that I would say it's roughly 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, wow. So you're right on the cutting edge. You're on the cusp of very new things. That's exciting.
Yeah, it is. And even though the field has 4 or 5 years old, there's been very, very little research done on how that can be done in the context of adverse weather conditions like rain, fog, you know.
So you mentioned there's a lot of different information and data coming in from all these different sensors and I guess things that are giving the autonomous vehicle input. And then you're trying to make all of these different systems within each vehicle speak to one another. So how does that all work? How do you parse through all of that information and how do you assist the autonomous vehicle in making decisions based on its perception and the perception of other vehicles around it?
Yeah, it is pretty challenging.
Yeah, so it sounds very complicated.
It is. But it's fun. I really enjoy it. So there's different approaches to it. And the approach that has been most used in the literature is that if you just take raw sensor information, that's too much data. You know? So you have to communicate that data. And ideally, you would do that in almost real time, right? So raw data is too much. But Every autonomous vehicle, even the ones that are working by themselves, the way we make sense of all that data is with AI. It's okay. With deep learning models. So if we use the result of my AI model, so what it perceived mm-hmm. around it, mm-hmm. if we just use that result, then it's too little information, mm-hmm. you know, because what if the model doesn't get things perfectly, mm-hmm. you know, and then the errors compound, you know, so, and you end up losing information about the surroundings, you mm-hmm. know, so what people usually do is within the deep learned model, they get the intermediate features, you know, and then those features are communicated. And then for collaborative perception, we need models that will take as input data from different vehicles, you know, okay. and you can even make other agents mm-hmm. collaborate as well. There is research being done for having drones collaborating mm. with the vehicles. There's some people, I don't think that is a very promising step, but there okay. is some people also considering, I don't know, having data from smartphones, you know, so pedestrians mm-hmm. could be joining the collaboration mm-hmm. scheme. But the main thing is having either just cars mm-hmm. or cars and roadside units. So okay. mm-hmm. you have, I don't know, cameras at an intersection, mm-hmm. you know, those cameras could be like joining the collaboration and telling everyone, hey, there's this happening there.
There was a fender bender at this intersection and be aware.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like, because I can only imagine how hard it would be to compare different information from one type of vehicle to another, because it sounds a little bit like comparing apples to oranges at times, right? If, you know, the weather conditions affecting a drone might be very different than those affecting a vehicle and what they have to be concerned about. So as from a very public armchair perspective, mm-hmm. I can understand how making those kind of connections yeah. could be difficult. So trying to find data that is valuable across vehicles and across other agents, like you said, that can all better inform
yeah.
driving. And I can only imagine, but I guess you can tell me more, what makes adverse weather conditions so challenging for autonomous vehicles? Because I'm thinking even, you know, driving in Kingston winters, you know, one street to the next, the road conditions can really vary. So
yeah,
could you tell us a little bit about what makes these conditions challenging for autonomous vehicles, and how can collaborative perception help with some of those challenges?
Sure. Yeah. So just making a car drive by themselves is a very challenging mm-hmm. thing, but it has been done, you know. Mm-hmm. And we have everyone that drives knows this. We have a lot of boring scenarios mm-hmm. in driving. Most of driving is very boring, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just, I have to keep on my lane, you know, like make sure no one like just jump mm-hmm. ahead of me, you know.
And many times, right, if you drive the same route all the time, sometimes your mind wanders and all of a sudden yeah. you're like, I'm at work again. How did I get here safely? Yeah. But you just do those automatic boring things.
Yeah, mm-hmm. no, most of it, and the research shows mm-hmm. that it's something like 98% of driving. It's so boring.
Oh, wow.
It's so
wow.
predictable, yeah. you know. But you have those edge cases, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you have those crazy situations that you have to react in a split second, mm-hmm. right? So adverse weather goes more towards that edge case scenario thing, because it doesn't rain all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't snow all the time. It's not completely foggy that you can't even see in front of you mm-hmm. properly. You know, that happens, I don't know, a couple of days a year, you know?
And not even consistently across an area, right?
Yeah.
You drive through one patch of fog and then cross the street, and then the fog's lifted a little bit. So it's constantly evolving.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And even an adverse weather condition that I tried to explore in my master's was glare. So mm-hmm. It's the sun is setting or mm-hmm. the sun is rising, and then you have that super blinding light like mm-hmm. right in front of you, you know? So if you just turn right, there's no more light bothering mm-hmm. you know? So it changes a lot. So those kinds of situations, they don't happen all the time, and they make the sensor performance like really, really degrade, mm. you know? So the same way it's challenging for us to make sense of things mm-hmm. when it's too dark, when it's too foggy, when there's so much rain or snow that you can barely see, I don't know, like 20 meters in mm-hmm. front of you. The same thing is true for sensors like mm-hmm. cameras and even LiDARs, you know? So by having vehicles collaborating, we can hope that, well, I can only see 20 meters in front of me, but 20 meters in front of me, there might be a vehicle that can tell me what he's seeing, you know? Mm-hmm, so we mm-hmm. can all share our perceptions, and then we can have a much broader field of view, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that really helps to increase the perception when those challenging situations happen.
Oh, no, that sounds helpful for those who are looking to kind of crowdsource safety on the road. Yeah. So this, it makes a lot of sense. This work seems very applied. But how have you tested all of this? So what have you been doing during your master's to try all of this? Because I imagine you can't exactly take AVs out on the road around Kingston at this point to do this type of testing. So how have you been approaching this in your master's?
Yeah, you mentioned something that is a very big challenge in within this specific subfield that I entered, which is getting real data. This is so tricky. Queens has, I think, more than one autonomous vehicle.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And there's the AutoDrive team, the undergrad team, they have a car. My supervisor with another professor, Professor Nuruddin, they also have a car, which recently they even published a huge data set with the car getting data around Kingston.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for collaborative perception, you need more than one.
Yes.
One is not enough anymore. And for collaborative perception under adverse weather conditions, you can't collect data anytime.
Mm-hmm.
You need those adverse weather situations to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it super impractical to get real data. So the answer was, okay, let's go to simulation.
Oh, good. Yes, you can't wait for a winter storm and then hope that you can get data that day, right? So,
yeah.
So what type of simulations?
Oh, it's foggy, let's get the car.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I'm sure the car is a heavily scheduled hot commodity as well if everyone is wanting to use the AV. So you develop simulations or you work with those. How does that play out?
Yeah, so there is a very popular open source simulator used by people in self-driving research called Carla.
Okay.
And Carla, think of it as a kind of a sandbox thing, a sandbox world where it can decide where you are going to put a car. It has some maps with cities and intersections and things like that. But you have a lot of freedom to do so many different things within Carla. It's for people that have worked with game design, it's pretty much like having a game engine with some pre-made assets there.
Okay.
So within Carla, we set up everything, set up scenarios, and we set up scenarios that felt meaningful from a practical point of view. We wanted scenarios that were challenging, scenarios that really made the perception algorithms to struggle and to see if collaborative perception would make those situations better. So we looked at real data from lots of reports from the United States National Health Traffic Administration, and we found some interesting situations. Because in the field, sometimes people will just randomly decide, well, highways are an interesting situation. Off ramps from highways, they're an interesting scenario. And then you see the real data, and in fact those are not the most interesting scenarios, you know, for perception.
Okay. So no problem getting merging or getting off of the highway, but
not from a perception point of view, because those situations you can perceive your environment very well. Those might be more challenging from a perspective of control, of how how you control the car when it's going faster, right? But then that's later in the, in the pipeline.
You're still at the beginning, of the process.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we got data from what would be interesting scenarios for perception algorithms.
So what are some of those interesting scenarios? What are some examples of what is hard to perceive?
So lots and lots and lots of crashes happen in intersections.
Okay.
Intersections are challenging because there's a lot of variables to it, a lot of erratic behavior, right? So we consider both urban scenarios and rural scenarios. And in rural scenarios, there's a lot of things involved. Curved roads, you know, when you get a known junction, you have accidents happening and troubles with perceiving objects around you. In level roads, non-level roads, you know, straight roads, there's a whole variety to it, you know. So we basically picked up five scenarios, we tried to make them a little bit general, not extremely specific. And then by using those five road configurations, then we simulated lots of different adverse weather combinations there. So clear weather, of course, we need to have a baseline, but also light rain, heavy rain, fog, foggy have you rain. have you ever seen that?
It is not pleasant to drive in.
Not at all. and even glare, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. glare, from all that we looked in the literature, mm-hmm. it was not something that was explored in collaborative perception. So, well, let's do it, mm-hmm. right? And the results for glare were pretty interesting because when we are thinking about collaborative perception, there's always a main vehicle, right? Mm-hmm. The main vehicle we call the ego, okay. meaning like the self, right? Mm-hmm. So the ego, its perception in glare, it's terrible because there's a lot of light, mm-hmm. very strong light coming its way. But by collaborating with the other agents, it's so much better. You know, mm-hmm. it's improved so much, you know? Yeah.
Oh, so that's well, it makes sense though, right? As soon as you can get away from that one bit of sunlight,
yeah.
you're able to see again as a human driver. So it makes a lot of sense with collaborative perception as well, that as long as you can pull data from other places that aren't, you know, driving straight into the sunset, you're able to make better sense of the road areas around,
yeah.
And go from there. So you did a lot of testing. What is something from your research that you would like to pursue further? Like what's something you want to know more of now that you've done all of this work for your master's?
Yeah. So the main thing of the master's was creating the simulated data set, okay. and simulating mm-hmm. all those scenarios and making sure everything was running smoothly, mm-hmm. that everything made sense. We looked at real data to account for which scenarios to pick, what kind of sensor configurations mm-hmm. to use and everything. But then once the data set was done, we had this idea to, well, now that we have those adverse weather scenarios that are challenging for collaborative perception AI models, let's make a model then.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And that was so challenging. That was so difficult. And it's something we try to do, but then because of the timing of the mm-hmm, masters, mm-hmm. That's something we put aside.
Okay.
And instead, mm-hmm. our idea was, okay, let's look at the existing models and improve their robustness mm. to adverse weather. And that's what I did at the last few months of my master's. But definitely then, that would be an avenue for future research, right? Mm-hmm. To create a model, that an AI model that is a lot more robust to mm-hmm. all those adverse weather conditions that we have created in the simulation.
Is that something that you would like to pursue in the future, or... Because I know you mentioned you wanted to be a researcher. Is that a next step for your research, or what is your next step for your research?
To be completely honest, I don't know.
That's totally fair. Yeah,
it is a very interesting mm-hmm. field. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. And I already got a lot of familiarity with it. I will be doing my PhD here at Queen's.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you.
Okay.
Starting in September. So people listening to this, I'll not be a master's student anymore. I'll be a PhD already.
Yes, you will. That'll be exciting.
Yeah. So in my PhD, the idea is to keep working with autonomous vehicles okay. and perception mm-hmm. for them. But what specifically are we going to target? Mm-hmm. That is still not defined, especially because in the PhD, you have a lot more time.
Yes, you'll have. Yes. Hopefully double the time, right? And
yeah.
ideally to deep dive into something. And now that you've already done all of this work,
yeah.
If you continue pursuing this, you have already a wealth of knowledge to yeah. to work from instead of having to start from scratch, so to say, right?
Yeah.
So.
No, but at the same time, as I was doing all this work mm-hmm. and reading about the field, there are a lot of open questions that mm-hmm. we found, a lot of different things that could be worked on. And even in the context of adverse weather conditions, there's a question of how to do that.
Mm.
So thinking of an AI model, there's lots of different kinds of AI models being used mm-hmm. nowadays. So one thing that has been used a lot for single vehicle perception that I don't think I have seen for collaborative perception is something called the diffusion model.
Okay.
So that's something that could be used. LLMs like ChatGPT, mm-hmm. which are the large language models, there's people doing visual large language models and vision large language models. And how to integrate those large models mm-hmm. to the self-driving
mm-hmm. so.
Pipeline, you know? So there's a lot of things that are very, very important mm-hmm. right now for self-driving and collaborative perception. So let's see.
Yes. It sounds like you're going to have the challenge of trying to pare down all of your interests and ideas, you're going to have to be selective, I guess. And so you've almost got too many options, which I think is a good place to be, right? You get to explore a little bit and then find what feels best.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. As this airs, we'll be excited to see how you're doing in your PhD, and hopefully we can have you back on Grad Chat in the future once you've kind of chosen the direction and you've got some more work done. But I hear that you're also, outside of your research on vehicles, this is a bit of a stretch, but I know you're also a big Formula One fan.
I am.
So who are your favorite drivers right now, and what is exciting to you about Formula One?
Lewis Hamilton.
Very nice.
When I started watching Formula One, I felt a little off about him. Mm-hmm. He seemed like that kind of celebrity that this is very fake, mm-hmm. you know? And then I realized, I saw some interviews, you know, and I realized that he's actually very real, you know, mm-hmm. and he's a very big activist for mm-hmm. a lot of causes. The main one being having black kids in STEM, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. in motorsport, but also just in mm-hmm. engineering as a whole. So he has a lot of initiatives. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of things that he doesn't even advertise about, you know.
Okay.
The Met Gala, mm-hmm. he once got a full table with black designers.
Very, very nice.
And it's not something that he advertised much, you know. It just, the Met Gala happened and there he was in mm-hmm. a table with lots of designers that he sponsored, you know. So he's the kind of people that puts his money where his mouth is. Mm-hmm. So
he just acts quietly on his values and
yeah.
has that, and then people report on it after, but he's just doing that because that's who he is. That's what it sounds like.
So I got to really admire Lewis Hamilton as I got to watch more and more Formula One, but unfortunately, right now, he's not doing the best, so he will not be a champion this year, probably not. So a champion contender right now is to be possibly his first champion will be Oscar Piastri, and he's the guy I'm hoping, let's go Piastri.
And what do you like about Formula One? What excites you about it?
It's the racing itself mm-hmm. is so much fun. There's a lot of unpredictability. Mm. There are races that are honestly very boring, that the way it begins, it's the way it ends. But when you least expect, you will see insanely good drives from the drivers. You see, I don't know, it starts to rain and then everyone has to stop and put the wet tires, and then things become chaotic. Mm. And then it's when you see the drivers and their skill really making a difference. But it's also a team sport. Mm-hmm. Every driver is part of a team and they have a teammate. And sometimes you see the team making a lot of the difference with crazy strategies, mm-hmm. something like, oh, this is not going to work. But then it does. And then they win the race. And you're on the edge of your seat. How did that work, you know?
It sounds like, what I'm hearing, it sounds like there's a lot of similarity between kind of what you described in your research, right? It's sometimes, a lot of the time, driving can be pretty boring. Maybe not Formula One boring, but it can be pretty regular. And then when there's these kind of challenges or adverse conditions, everyone adjusts, and that's the excitement piece. And that sounds kind of, I mean, I could be stretching here, but that sounds like what you're doing as well, as you're stretching and finding those challenges and then coming up with a solution within your team, within your lab, really quickly, and trying to figure out how to come around those.
Yeah.
And I know from the beginning you mentioned that you have really enjoyed your time in Kingston, and I know you've been quite active, and I see that you were an events ambassador for Queens. Could you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Sure. Yeah. So there's this group in Queens called Queens Events. Mm-hmm. So anyone can go to their Instagram, Queens Events. And it's basically this idea started by an alumni, mm-hmm. Sarah Witiuk, I think that's how you pronounce her name. And it was this whole idea of giving people the information of what's happening in Kingston. Mm-hmm. Because she felt that a lot of the times she would hear about the cool things happening after they happened.
You know?
So there's that whole FOMO kind mm-hmm. of feeling, you know. And so let's give that information to students and let's try to put all that information together. Mm-hmm. So I started following the page before moving to Canada. Mm-hmm. I got my acceptance, I think it was something like March.
Okay.
And then I just came in end of August to Kingston. So I wanted to know everything about Queens, about Kingston, and even CFRC. I was listening to CFRC before coming here, and it was a lot of fun. And by following the Queen's Event Instagram page, I saw that they had a position open for an ambassador. Mm. And the idea is simple. You just go to events and you post about it so people can see what's mm-hmm. what how the event is, right? And then I did that for my first year here in Kingston. I did that and it was so much fun. It was a great excuse to just mm-hmm. leave home and go explore the city and find cool things to do.
Yeah, because there's sometimes the thing is there's so many things happening.
Yeah.
In Kingston and at Queens that you almost don't know what to choose. So yeah. what were some of your favorite events from that year while you were an ambassador? What are some things you tried?
Oh, wow. I went to so many concerts, more indie rock concerts, classical music mm-hmm. at the Isabel. I would say that my number one favorite was the Intercultural Arts Fest. Mm-hmm. It happens every year. Mm-hmm. So I think it's in August. So...
That sounds right to me. Yes. Yeah.
So people hearing, go next year.
Yes.
But coming from Brazil, in Brazil, you don't have as much multiculturalism mm-hmm. as you have in Canada. Brazil is a melting pot of cultures. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of people coming from all over the world, you know, to Brazil. But then you don't see those cultures as they were originally. Mm-hmm. It all gets blended together, you mm-hmm. know. So... I don't know. We have sushi pizza, like we have had them for years, you know. Mm-hmm. There's the Russian dish stroganoff, mm-hmm. and there's the Arabic dish sfiha. Mm-hmm. We have stroganoff, sfiha, you know, like Brazil does this crazy combinations of things. So you have a very varied mm-hmm. and diverse culture, but you don't really have the traditions. Mm-hmm. You don't have... the originals.
More of the nuance to some of the traditions. And,
yeah.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. coming to Canada and going to the Intercultural Arts Fest, mm-hmm. I saw traditional dance, mm-hmm. traditional mm-hmm. music, you know, from all over the world. Traditional dishes, though, those were so good, mm-hmm. you know. So it felt really special and it reminded me why when deciding where to do my master's, mm-hmm. the country I picked was Canada. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was... not only because of research excellence mm-hmm. and because it's a great place to live, but because of the multiculturalism. Mm. I mm-hmm. felt like Canada would be a country where I would be welcomed and that I would get to meet people from all over the world and their cultures would be appreciated here. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely the case. And it's awesome.
Well, I'm glad that you had great experiences with Queen's Events and hopefully... like you said, everyone listening can attend next summer's Intercultural Fair Arts Fest and check out some amazing events throughout the whole year in the community and on campus because there's so much going on.
Yeah,
right?
I sometimes talk to people and they say, there's nothing happening in Kingston. And then I look at them baffled. What do you mean? There's so much going on, you know? I think it's just a matter of what you look for and mm-hmm. where to look for, you know? So the city of Kingston itself... organizes so many things. Mm-hmm. At Queens, you have so many student groups and even the groups from the university, like the School of Graduate mm-hmm. Studies. There's so many things happening all the time.
There are. And if I can pitch the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, we have an excellent weekly newsletter that tries to compile events mostly on campus, but we do include off-campus events as well and things, scholarships, events, opportunities. So that's one way to stay in touch and get a heads up about some of the stuff that's happening around.
Yeah, for sure. For anyone thinking Kingston doesn't have much to do, I would say just think about what interests you and look out. I would say that there is, mm-hmm. you know, there's things happening for every type of interest. Mm-hmm. For people more interested in sports, there's so many games happening all year
and
long.
So many teams that you can join. And
yeah, mm-hmm. music, mm-hmm. arts, you know, crafts, mm-hmm. more nerdy things, you know, like board games. Mm-hmm. There's things for everyone.
Yes, we're very, very lucky to have strong communities. Well, thank you so much, Mateos. It's been great chatting with you. Thanks for doing Grad Chat and good luck with the PhD. And as I said, hopefully we'll get a chance to speak with you as your doctoral research gets underway in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great fun to talk to you.
Well, so that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes,
Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. And until next week, this is KM on the FM.